Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
And I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Freaky, which is just Freaky Friday the 13th.
There you have it.
Basically, that is the four-word elevator pitch. Really tells you most of what you need to know about this movie. So I guess we'll just, that's all for this week. We are the Shock Doctors. Yeah.
He's Jim Smith. I'm Matt Gerandese. Until I stab him with this Aztecian knife, at which point I will be Jim Smith and he will be Matt Gerandese. And we will still be the Shock Doctors.
So, it was directed and co-written by Christopher Landon, who is the director of Happy Death Day and Happy Death Day to You, and also Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones.
The high point of his oeuvre, if you ask me, and possibly my co-host, I'm not sure.
I'm a little more favorably disposed toward the original Happy Death Day than you are.
I like the first Happy Death Day. Okay. Freaky is very much cut from the same cloth as those two movies.
It's
far be it for me to long for the halcyon days of the Paranormal Activity franchise having monolithic, ubiquitous influence over the horror genre. But for whatever reason, Marked Ones, it just tickles me. I like it more than any of the other installments, with the possible exception of the very first one. I think it is my favorite, though, and not just for insufferable hipster reasons.
If this movie's cut from the same cloth as Happy Death Day and Happy Death Day to You, it's cut from rejected remnants of a discarded bolt of cloth, I would say.
I would not disagree. I fear that our viewers would not notice if I were to stab you with an Aztecian knife because we agree so much, but I think this is an episode where we're going to see more or less eye to eye.
Yeah, this is not The Turning.
Yeah, we're not going to relitigate that brouhaha.
No. The movie follows a teenage girl named Millie who gets chased and eventually stabbed by the Blissfield Butcher. Yes, their town is named Blissfield, which is absurd. The Blissfield Butcher is played by Vince Vaughn, and given that you've basically heard the premise, the draw for this movie is Vince Vaughn acting like a teenage girl, which I will admit is mildly amusing, at least some of the time. He takes this special knife and jabs her, and after some timing mishaps that we'll get into later, they switch bodies the following midnight, and then the rest of the movie is about Millie in Vince Vaughn's body trying to switch back.
If you thought that Rob Schneider's The Hot Chick was just missing a couple eyeball gougings and dudes getting sawed in half, then Freaky is the movie for you. Because the specter of the spectacle of Vince Vaughn being a teenage girl is very much like a vintage Rob Schneider. Like that's the. So this is a roundabout way for me to agree with your assessment of the cloth from which this movie is cut. It is a marked downgrade, I think.
Yeah. Well, without further ado, I guess we ought to launch into a synopsis. So. Take it away.
Yeah, I'll try to make this as fun as possible, although I don't invoke Rob Schneider lightly. You know, a lot of this is just comedy poison. We open on Wednesday the 11th. Four high schoolers are sitting around on somebody's porch drinking cheap beer and talking about the Blissfield Butcher committed a spate of killings in the 90s, I think, and then
there's already confusion. Yes. Like, first he killed some kids in the 70s, and then the 90s, maybe some of that's made up. It's all, yeah. Right from the get-go, it's muddled. And, you know, you could argue, well, that's commentary on how these tropes are always, it's about mythology and local folklore. And they even invoke that term, local folklore.
Yeah.
But it's still just seems sloppy.
It could have been a funny send-up of the idea of this being like the umpteenth installment in a long-running slasher franchise where the timeline is just a clusterfuck, but they don't commit to the bit enough to really sell that idea, although I think on the face of it, it is sort of a funny one. One guy spills beer on his girlfriend, or he scares her, she spills beer on herself, then storms off in a huff. He goes in to apologize, winds up wandering around It's a big house. Family's well-to-do. They've got a bunch of relics and knickknacks on the wall. There's a bunch of masks, one of which is missing, and a apocalypto-looking knife in a display case on a bar. And he inspects the placard in front of it, and it says La Dola. And he out loud, he goes, La Dola, what's that? Or words to that effect.
Well, this is the same kid who goes down into the basement, finds a wine rack, and takes a bottle of Montrachet off the rack and says, Mont Ratchet? So, you know, he gets no points for pronunciation in any language.
Yeah, he is startled, now drops the bottle, proceeds to stoop down, grab up some handfuls of glass.
This looks expensive, he says. How can you tell with wine spilled on the floor whether it looks I don't think even wine connoisseurs would contend.
Yeah, Paul Giamatti in Sideways would be hard pressed to tell what wine was
if spilled you spilled on the floor a of bottle dark, of Trader basement. Joe's house wine on the ground next to some fucking 200-year-old bottle of port, you wouldn't be able to tell, oh yeah, that's a cheap one. That's the expensive one.
It's a big, fancy house. I guess anyone who keeps their wine in a cellar, it's safe to assume that it's more than he makes at the fucking
roller rink or wherever he works. But again, it looks expensive. He doesn't say, like, man, that was probably expensive.
Well, he's a buffoon. You know, we're meant to just be counting the seconds until he expires, which
and
he proceeds to
do. There are not many.
No.
He gets a wine bottle shoved down. It's actually kind of a neat-looking kill. He gets a wine bottle shoved down his throat. And then smashed inside his neck.
Yeah, so it sort of fragments and comes
out.
Splintering through his neck skin. I would have, needless to say, preferred it if it was an old school, like Tom Savini looking thing. But it is conceptually a little unusual. So props for that. Killer then goes on a, what do you know, killing spree through this big house, picks off the rest of the teenagers. One of the girls puts up more of a fight than her friends. You would be forgiven for thinking that she might be the protagonist, but then she gets offed. This is also a little bit conceptually clever. He lobs a spear at her. Again, lots of relics and knickknacks lying around, and it misses. And then after some cat and mouse antics, where she briefly appears to teleport into Narnia, she hides in a wardrobe. He opens it and she's just gone. And then there's a rich person, Wayne trapdoor back there.
Well, it's her house, I think. So it would make sense that if there were such a thing, she would know that it was there.
Right. So she reemerges, tries to tiptoe outside, and then gets got. And he mounts her
on
the blunt end of the spear sticking out of the wall. And then in a very overt homage to the original Halloween, Vince Vaughn does the Michael Myers head tilt. I refer to it as the Michael Myers head tilt often on this program, but the kill in Halloween where he does that is when he mounts the guy on the wall and then regards him like he's a piece of art that he's hung up. Parents come in, scream their heads off. Lo and behold, the knife is missing. Yes. The Aztecian knife.
That probably doesn't sound quite right to you. We'll get there.
If it sounds right to you, consult a doctor. You may be Christopher Landon. Or his
or Michael Kennedy.
Whose name escapes me. Very good.
Right.
So now we meet our actual protagonist, who is a different 17, 18-year-old blonde chick, name of Millie. It is now Thursday the 12th, for those of you keeping track at home.
Day one, day two.
Millie comes downstairs, eats a kind of sad, perfunctory breakfast with her mom, who is trying too hard to keep the family together. Millie's got an older sister who's a cop, and the cop just wants to dine and dash. The mom wants them to be a little nuclear unit, and there's crosstalk about how, oh, we don't do things together enough ever since Dad died, left.
Died.
Died.
I think.
But the line gets cut off, which just makes it feel even more
perfunctory.
Fun phoned in, yeah. The funniest thing to come from this scene is when the cop sister, whose name I don't recall.
Charlene.
Charlene, right, looks into the trash and sees an empty bottle of Chardonnay. The mom's been hitting the sauce more than either of her offspring would like. And Charlene, the label on the bottle says Swan Song Chardonnay. And I just remember thinking, God, that's the saddest, like, most on the nose. It's like if the sister had looked into the trash and seen a bottle of grieving mom Chablis. Grieving widow Chablis or something like that. So...
bottle of Sad Sack Jack. New product from the Jack Daniel's distillery.
Yeah. Millie goes to school. We meet a veritable rogues gallery of guys and gals, the usual assortment of Zoomer stereotypes that you get in movies like this.
Although, and this happens much later, but I'm just going to bring it up now so I don't forget. One of these, again, Zoomers calls Millie Vanilli at one point. No Zoomer has ever heard of Millie Vanilli.
God in heaven, no. Millie Vanilli is slightly before my time. I mean, not before I was born, but before I was cognizant of pop culture goings-ons.
Yeah, so get your shit together, Christopher Landon. That's all I'm saying.
It's the kind of pop culture illusion that's so out of touch that it wasn't even a case of like, oh, that made me feel old, me as a soon-to-be 30-year-old. It made me feel young. Which is really right. Which is really dire.
Yeah, that's bad.
So Millie is crushing on a dude named Booker. She has two friends, Nyla and something.
Josh.
And an adversary named Ryler. And the first time the name Ryler was said aloud, you said it just in disbelief. You just repeated it. And then I said, that sounds like a Pokemon. It would be like she said, oh, hi, Growlithe.
See, we have Ryler and Rhydon and Rhyhorn. Ryler's the missing basic Pokemon we never knew we needed.
And this was before I realized that the name they use for the cop sister is Char. Like, fuck it.
Char!
So that...
They're all Pokemon!
Yeah, it's... Some of the dialogue in this movie would have been improved by the characters only emphatically repeating their own name.
Their own names.
Millie goes to shop class. She's seated next to Booker. They have a little bit of awkward, flirty banter that doesn't get off the ground because...
Professor Cameron Howe is a huge dick.
Because the shop class teacher is a fascist maniac who has deliberately set Millie up to fail, asks her to present her doghouse that she's supposed to have built a week in advance, you know, a week in advance of the deadline she was assigned. I mean,
like, your failure to be prepared, you move the goalposts, you fucking douchebag.
Yeah, I mean, and this is an old trope, but Christopher Landon lays it on with a kind of egregious... He really puts the pedal to the metal. I was reminded of, I don't remember the actor's name. He's one of the loonies in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He's like the English teacher in Carrie. He makes fun of Sissy Spacek for calling a poem beautiful at one point. He's like, beautiful. Do you remember that?
I don't.
Okay. Anyway, I'm not against dickhead teachers in movies like this, but he has just like such a hatred hard on for her that is never explained.
Nope.
And he singles her out specifically. He's not just like a free-range kind of surly asshole teacher. It's very odd. So that night after a football game, Millie is waiting to get picked up by her mom, who is passed out on the couch at home. Char comes home and finds her in that state, then goes to the school to pick up her sister. Millie, meanwhile, is watching a sinister, burly, masked figure.
The masked figure.
Staring at her. A Vince Vaughn-shaped masked figure staring at her from across the parking lot. Figure then starts to advance. There's a chase sequence. He tracks her into the middle of the football zone. Christ, I didn't even watch the Super Bowl
field,
2 days ago.
Matt, Jesus Christ.
The first word my brain defaulted to was arena. But that can't possibly be right. So he tracks her into the middle of the football place, and then stabs her.
The football diamond.
With the Aztecian knife. At which point, a straight up like Mayan pyramid materializes underneath them. Clouds roll over the moon. And no,
they don't just roll over the moon. They like eat the moon.
Yeah, they consume the moon. And then Vince Vaughn reels back. He's been unmasked during their scuffle,
yeah.
I believe, because you see him wincing because his shoulder has spontaneously started bleeding.
Yeah. And then, inexplicably, they do not switch bodies right then.
No.
The movie has to wait.
It's not Thursday the 12th now, is it? Well, I know it is Thursday the 12th. But
and
I
that's
mean,
the problem.
Folklorically, it's not. Yeah, it's not Thursday the 12th that everyone's afraid of. It's not when Jason Voorhees stalks the grounds of Camp Crystal Lake.
No, it's the movie has to wait like 5 hours of story time.
Yeah. Long enough for Char to show up and scare Vince Vaughn off with flamethrower. Or I was trying to think of a Pokemon attack. I'm pretty sure that's one of them.
Yeah, no, that's, you got it.
Well, it calls to mind an image of her wielding an actual flamethrower like fucking Ripley, which would have been cool, but a little incongruous.
Yes.
Long enough for that to happen, long enough for Millie to go to the hospital and get patched up and then go home and go to bed.
And
the next morning, we get our Freaky Friday fortune cookie body swap.
Yeah. So the butcher in Millie's body wakes up and is nonverbal for a very long time.
It might just be because I dislike most of Christopher Landon and his co-writers' banter so much, but I was really taken with this stretch of this performance. When she wakes up, she moves like the Lady Terminator from Rise of the Machines. It's just completely inhuman. She's just a murder automaton. And yeah, totally nonverbal and borderline feral. When she goes downstairs to eat bacon and eggs, she's shoveling it into her mouth
with her hands,
with her bare hands.
Meanwhile, Millie in Vince Vaughn's body wakes up in the tropiest murder shack possible.
Yeah, wakes up on a dirty mattress inside the music video for Closer by Nine Inch Nails. Just surrounded by taxidermied animals and mannequins with nails driven into their faces and who knows what. You get the picture.
Yeah.
This is where the hot chick routine begins in earnest. Vince Vaughn with a lilting voice and limp wrists going like, oh, why do I sound like that? Why do I look like that? A bum, like,
Wants drugs
and doesn't know that this is a murder shack, apparently. And Millie in the killer's body extricates herself from that situation. There's a very Rob Schneider-y, like, I'll suck your dick joke, you know, very early 2000s.
Yeah, and then there's like a 5 second pause and it hasn't cut away yet. And we suddenly find out why. The bum says, all of it. Was that necessary?
Just useless. If the shot had lingered for another 15 seconds, just his crestfallen face as he looks down at the floor and then turns and says, oh, gee, I really wanted those drugs. Man, what a bummer. This is just not my day. Friday the 13th, am I right?
And then there's nobody here to talk to.
Or blow for drugs.
Or both.
In either order. Beggars can't be choosers. So, Millie, which is to say the murderer in Millie's body, selects an outfit and goes to school. Cue this long slow-mo sequence of her strutting her stuff through the front doors and going down the hallway. For some reason, being body-jacked by a grubby serial killer has precipitated a glow-up.
Yeah.
And she's now the hottest chick in town. Everyone's agog at how it's like it's set up so ineptly. It reminded me of the classic ugly girl and then you take off her glasses and suddenly she's prom queen.
Oh yeah, no, that's exactly what it is.
But it was set up so ineptly that I didn't even realize that she was supposed to be undesirable to begin with, because she just looks almost identical, to the point where it's almost like a fourth wall breaking gag about how silly that trope is. But again, the movie doesn't insist on the silliness of it quite enough to make me want to extend it the benefit of the doubt in that regard.
Yeah, and inexplicably, even though I'm just gonna say the butcher
Sure.
For most
not,
of the remainder
the
of the movie.
Not Butcher.
Yeah, no. But as opposed to explaining in Millie's body, it's just, it's
the
Butcher.
The Butcher, yes.
Yeah, until the climax. So the Butcher, despite not knowing how to walk around or move in Millie's body or really talk.
Or eat.
Apparently the Butcher knows how to apply makeup.
Yeah.
Pulled
up a couple YouTube tutorials before class, I guess.
You put that glow up together rather expertly.
Mm-hmm. So the Butcher proceeds to, not all at once, it's interspersed with Millie business. The Butcher proceeds to get revenge on Millie's behalf. Like all the, Growlithe, what is her actual name?
Ryler.
Ryler and the shop class teacher and all the people who had been antagonizing Millie continue to antagonize Millie. And the Butcher doesn't take kindly to that. And that makes a kind of sense, although it's weird to see the villain having the protagonist's revenge for her. It feels like it's supposed to be wish fulfillment for Millie, but Millie's not there to experience it.
Right.
So it doesn't land the way that I think it was meant to. First, the Butcher offs Ryler. What is that device?
It's a cryotherapy thing.
Okay.
That must be a rich-ass high school. That's some, like, NFL shit. Why the fuck do they have it in a high school locker room?
Yeah, so Ryler finds Millie, the actual Millie, showering in the, like, gymnasium showers and freaks out because, oh my god, it's the killer, a sketch of whom has been disseminated.
Yeah.
Runs into the Butcher, and the Butcher tricks her into this state-of-the-art cryotherapy thing, and she gets frozen like Walt Disney. And
well, speaking of, as we were a few minutes ago, of Terminator, frozen like the T-1000.
Sure.
Because
solid. Oh yeah, when she falls, she shatters into 100 pieces.
Yeah,
right?
And she falls when Millie finds her shortly thereafter.
Speaking of this being a ritzy fucking high school, Millie tracks down her friends and chases them into a really expansive kitchen environment. They're hitting each other with pots and pans and ladles and trays of chicken nuggets that have just been left sitting out. It goes on and on and on. She cannot persuade them that she is Millie.
Well, it doesn't really try for the first, like, 5 minutes. It's just like, guys, it's me. No, really. Seriously, I'm not here to hurt you. It's me.
Yeah, Tom Hanks tries harder in Big when his mom finds him, and he didn't look like the Boston Strangler. He just looked like some guy. Yeah, she doesn't do the obvious thing, which is to say something right off the bat that only Millie would know. We get this long, drawn-out Three Stooges, or would-be Three Stooges sequence before that happens. And then, doubling down on the Rob Schneiderism of it all, she
does her mascot dance.
Yeah, because
we saw at the football game.
Right. She does her cheerleader routine of a kind, and a lot of swaying hips and so on. So they figure out that the knife is responsible for all this. The word Aztecian comes to the fore here.
Yes, this is where it comes in. And that might not sound right to you. It's because it's not. The adjectival version of Aztec is Aztec.
Uh-huh.
And a 15-second Google search would have established that. But apparently that was beyond Christopher Landon's means or what he deemed worthy of effort.
Yeah, I think that his Googling stopped at Google Translate. It stopped after he fed the words "the hurt" into Google Translate and got La Dola back.
Oh, God.
And they proceed then to call the knife the Dola for the rest of the movie, which reminded me of that old Chris Farley SNL sketch.
The Nino.
El Nino is Spanish for the Nino. So they figure out after 24 hours, the switch is permanent. So Millie has to stab the Butcher with the knife in order to do this hot potato routine, you know, get back where she belongs.
Yeah.
The Butcher obliterates the shop class teacher. There's a long scuffle. The one thing I like about this scene is that it demonstrates that the Butcher is not used to being so slight.
Yeah.
Thinks that he'll have the upper hand as soon as he springs his trap and then kind of gets his ass handed to him for a minute or two and then shoves a screwdriver into the shop class teacher's throat and then saws him in half on a big old bandsaw.
Table saw, yeah.
Table saw, rather. Shop class teacher spends that whole scene It's like Philip Seymour Hoffman in Mission Impossible 3 or something. It's just scene-chewing villainy for the sake of it. That doesn't make any sense on such a peripheral character. Really, really bizarre. There's a scene in a spooky mini-golf zone, arena, court, where our heroes incapacitate the butcher and add a new member to their company. Booker, is that his name?
Yeah.
The boy that Millie's been crushing on.
Yeah, this is after Millie and friends get chased off campus.
Right.
By the police.
Yeah, there's now a straight up manhunt going on, which proceeds to take up much of the rest of the movie.
Yeah, so the party decamps to Josh's house where the butcher is tied up, and they decide, okay, once they bring Booker into it by Millie reciting a poem that she apparently crammed into his locker, this would have been a lot more prepared for if we had seen her do that. I mean, we know from the get-go, at the beginning of the movie, that she's into this dude, but just, you know, again, just a shot of
Vince
her
Vaughn
slipping the note in there.
Just starts reciting this
turgid
shitty,
poetry.
Off-the-charts shitty, like, Tumblr poetry. And we figure out, based on the expression on Booker's face, that he's heard it somewhere before. But we don't know the particulars until they explain it, and so it can't...
It's so baffling. It's like there's a scene earlier on where they're hanging out. I think it's Nyla and Josh specifically are hanging out next to this like gallows scene decoration.
Oh, yeah.
Like there's a gallows and a noose
Charlie Challenge,
hanging.
Bro.
So I thought, like, is this like a monologue from a play they were in together sometime?
Mm-hmm.
This has not been prepared for at all. And, I mean, it still hadn't been prepared for, but it was a little simpler than that. Again, poem crammed in a locker. So this is the trick they use to establish her identity with Booker. The only reason his name is Booker is because they rhyme it with hooker either before or later. Also,
or both, I think.
Unless you're Booker T. Washington, Booker is a dumb name for a person.
It's not
as dumb
stupid
as Ryler.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
But pretty dumb.
So why do they go to the police station after this? Is that
they have to get the knife?
Is that where the knife is?
Yeah, it's in evidence.
Okay, that's right. Yes, so they're trying to reclaim the knife. They leave Josh alone to guard the butcher. His mom comes home early and unanticipated, and we get a violently unfunny scene. It reminded me of the scene in Happy Death Day to You where the lady pretends to be blind for multiple minutes.
Yep.
It's just dead on arrival, where he has to pretend, oh, it's a role play thing that Millie and I are doing. Mom, I'm straight. It's a reverse coming out thing, and the mom doesn't buy it. And meanwhile, the butcher is fiddling with the knot and eventually gets loose and starts running around wielding a kitchen knife.
Chasing them into the bedroom. Meanwhile, Millie and Booker are in the car by themselves, and they have this sort of heart-to-heart talk, and this teenage boy begins making out with Vince Vaughn just cuz.
It could have been kind of sweet. You know, I mean, he says, you're still Millie to me, and that's, I don't know if it's progressive or transgressive or what, or it really, at this point I was so checked out that it didn't really register for me emotionally at all, but I at least, it's not as no homo as it could have been. I mean, this movie is kind of, again, Rob Schneider-y across the board and a little retrograde, but that one moment was in theory a little bit sweet, but then they cut it off.
Yeah.
And Vince Vaughn's like, let's resume this at a later date, presumably so that the audience doesn't get too squicked out.
Right. Nyla is in the police station. She uses some subterfuge to get Charlene, who's the only cop there at the moment, to go outside looking for the butcher so she can retrieve the knife from the evidence locker. Charlene comes back in. What are you doing? Pulls a gun on her, which Nyla's a black girl. Charlene is not.
Yeah.
The messaging is not great. I wouldn't have thought they'd structure that way, times being what they are, but they did.
More on that after the break, as fate would have it.
Yeah. There's a standoff for an improbably long time. Josh comes running in off the street, and so do Millie and Booker, and there's a scuffle, and the Butcher gets away. Charlene ends up getting shoved in a cell, blah, blah, blah. The Butcher's loose, and they chase after him.
The Butcher, meanwhile, has orchestrated... So Homecoming has been canceled, and we get from the opening scene that the Butcher's murder sprees tend to coincide with Homecoming.
Yeah.
In this town of Blisswater, Blissfield, that's what it's called. And
Blissburg.
Scenic New Blissburg.
So Dimmsdale.
You're right. So Millie and some of her new cohorts, sorry, the Butcher and some of his new cohorts, jock dickhole types, have thrown together a grassroots homecoming. It's just like a
fucking rave.
Yeah.
At the old mill, which is, I believe, where the Butcher has been living. But now it's all, you know, it's dark and it's strung up with neon and whatnot. Again, looks like a rave.
Rave at the Old Mill sounds like the title of, it sounds like something R.L. Stine would have written. Like one of his books for teenagers.
Right,
like,
right.
Murder on Fear Street or whatever that series was called. Anyway, this is the scene where someone calls her Millie Vanilli.
Yes.
And I was like, Christ.
And it's aggressively
They might as well be blasting Color Me Bad. Anyway, the funnies dry up in a big way because a bunch of the jocks get Millie alone and threaten her with gang rape in no uncertain terms, very graphic terms, actually. And then she murders all of them, which is nice.
Right. Again, the Butcher.
Yes.
In Millie's body.
Correct.
Meanwhile, Millie and her friends show up and, you know, they split up and they only have 13 minutes. Booker gives Millie his Apple Watch or whatever the fuck it is with an alarm for midnight. And again, there are details. They're not worth recounting. There's a pursuit. Eventually, they tackle the Butcher and are about to do the stabbing. And then beep, 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 beep. No.
Now, this reveal is going to be less annoying for you than it was for us.
Because we elided it.
Uh-huh.
So earlier on, the first time Millie goes into shop class when she's still in her own body, she sits next to Booker and she gets a harangue from Alan Ruck about being late and being a fuck up. He just says something like, pro tip, set your watch 5 minutes ahead. That way you'll always be on. It saves my butt all the time. And we get a flashback, and we get this entire scene played over again.
With like a gauzy white filter over it, like they're in heaven. It's like he died, and she's flashing back to something he said when he was still alive. It's that kind of Hallmark film grammar.
Yeah, so they still have a little under 5 minutes to get this thing done.
Ample time. Time enough that I thought the Butcher was going to get back off the ground and we were going to resume the climax, because it's like in a Galaxy Quest, how the countdown can only stop at 1 second. It's like, if you stop the countdown with 5 minutes to spare, it's not even enough time for me to break a sweat.
Right.
In a hypothetical scenario, sure, where sure. I was really on the edge of my seat for any of this. But I was kind of eager for the movie to kind of pack it in and let the credits roll, unfortunately. Because there's a bit of a fake out here where the cops show up, plug the Butcher, who is now actually the Butcher, back in Vince Vaughn's body, full of holes. And we think he's dead. The ambulance carts him off. He flatlines. But oh, what's this?
He's taken the little heart monitor clip off of his finger. So he's got him fooled. Millie and Booker have their visually appropriate makeout session now.
Yes, their heteronormative makeout.
And then, Millie goes home and she's cuddling with her mom, Charlene. They're all getting along. It's all great. And then Millie hears a noise and walks through her entire house until finally Vince Vaughn shows up behind her. There's a scuffle.
Well, Vince Vaughn starts monologuing a bunch. And the thing I liked about the Butcher, whatever body he was in, is that highly taciturn. And all of a sudden he turns into fucking Hannibal Lecter, is just talking her ear off, trying to pick her brains, and it doesn't work at all. You know, you can be Michael Myers, or you can be this loquacious serial killer who knows all the angles and talks their victims to death. You cannot be both.
Yeah, not both. Eventually, Charlene shows up with her gun, but apparently took all the bullets out. And then Mom comes to the rescue. They all get knocked to the ground. Millie gets knocked to the ground. And then, you know what I learned in your body? Having balls sucks. This is another thing that was prepared for.
Mm-hmm.
When Millie is chasing her friends in the butcher's body, she gets a kick to the nuts.
Yeah, sack tap.
And so kicks him in the balls. And then it turns into Endgame. Where all the Avengers
you quipped, it's like they're killing Thanos. It was like he goes down hard, Vince Vaughn.
He gets the kick to the nuts, and then Mom hits him with a chair, and then Charlene fucking hits him with something else, and then Millie takes one of the broken chair legs and stabs him in the back, and then like kicks it all the way through his chest. And
I thought at that point that he was going to lean forward like the fucking Uruk Hai in Fellowship and be like, like he was still alive. That's how like, fucking long.
pull out the chair leg and lick it. You know,
it's got his still beating heart skewered on the tip. But no, he is actually dead. So I really thought the movie was going to end after you realized that his ambulance death was a fake out. And it would be shameless.
Oh, yeah. I thought that was a sequel hook for sure. But no, it's not. And when this little postscript ends, there is no post-credit sequence. Once we get the credits, it's all done.
Yeah, that knife is still floating around in an evidence bag. So Lord knows Christopher Landon could do all kinds of wacky things with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying they're not going to do a sequel. They'll probably do a sequel, but at least they didn't have a sequel hook.
Christopher Landon could even contrive a means of bringing Vince Vaughn back if he felt like it. I mean, probably. Fucking, he might just introduce a time machine like he did in the Happy Death Day follow-up.
It's true. It's true. Well, anyway, we're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with some stuff after that.
I woke up in the killer's body.
The Blissfield Butcher strikes again.
Don't freak out.
You're black. I'm gay. We are so dead.
Ow! Will you stop? It's me. It's Millie.
Hail, hail, Blissfield. Hi, feel our glory and our might.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim. Here, as always, during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
I have like less than 6 hours to swap back or I'm going to be stuck in his body forever.
Hurry up, loser. I got to take a dump.
I have to admit, it hasn't been all bad.
I'm sorry, sir. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Move! How's that feel?
I'll make you wish your stupid face was never born.
Oh my God, did you just pee yourself?
Yes!
Whoa, what am I wearing?
I'm actually really liking this for you. Great. We're gonna get killed by Murder Barbie.
And we're back. So I guess the first thing that I'd like to touch on is the sort of half-baked trans allegory that this movie is sometimes trying to be.
When it's not doing vintage
Rob Schneider chick stuff.
Yeah, right.
So really the two things that come to mind in terms of this, one we've already touched on, it's the aborted makeout session between Vince Vaughn and Booker. And then also there's during the keeping the butcher imprisoned in Josh's house scene, Nyla at one point chides him about pronouns.
Mm-hmm. Well, that the pronoun joke, I mean, that's how it registered for me, just felt like something out of Babysitter Killer Queen. You know, it's just like making fun of wokeness in a very kind of ho-hum, been there, done that sort of way.
And I guess to briefly digress on that, there's a little bit of that sprinkled throughout the movie. It riddles that first scene with the four kids who all get murdered at the mansion.
Yes.
The would-be final girl makes some crack about how, you know, never underestimate a white man's capacity for violence.
Because someone is trying to figure out how is it possible that the same killer has been...
geriatric murderer, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then she makes a crack about that. And then she and her boyfriend are fucking on the hood of a car at one point after their two friends are already dead. And when she decides she's done, she pushes him off. And then there's this sort of perfunctory back and forth about how when has a guy ever cared about whether a girl finishes or whatever. So it's like, okay.
That scene was really kind of stomach-churning, not for any of that, like, post-coital tete-a-tete, but because we jump into the hood of the car, doggy-style fuckfest, with a match cut from another girl getting her head caved in a toilet bowl.
That's true.
She's got the lid of a toilet slammed down over and over on her skull, which is starting to bend in a way that it's not meant to. And, you know, we cut from watching her die to watching this other girl get railed. And it's a match cut. I mean, it's set up so that they're occupying the same space in the frame. The motion is roughly the same. But it's, you know, it's really in an edgier movie that might have been striving to say something about how, oh, death and sex are both titillating. Slasher movies are all about sexualized carnage, you know, these nubile young teens getting impaled in this kind of phallic way. But here it just felt like that made me feel a little bit genuinely gross. Unclean. And it's tossed off so flippantly that you almost, I don't know, it took me a while to recover from it. I mean, by the time they were talking about, you know, like, oh, when does a guy ever blah, 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 I was still like, no, hold on.
Run that back a second. Wait a minute.
Don't, actually.
Well, right.
Please don't. And there's nothing else in the movie that's anywhere near that mean-spirited.
No.
And so I just didn't know what to make of that. I think it was just Christopher Landon being a fucking weirdo and nobody told him no. I don't know. It's the kind of thing that might work, like I said, in a different context where the movie is actually abrasive and has maybe something to say or is just trying to ruffle feathers. But that's not this movie. This movie is very digestible for the most part.
I guess to tie this off to what I opened with, it's like this movie is trying sporadically and fitfully to achieve some level of wokeness, whether through humor, ham-fisted as it may have been, or a halfway genuine, again, trans allegory. It's doing all this to sort of like, hey, no, look over here while we're doing this Rob Schneider routine. You're not fooling anybody.
Yeah, no. And just to be clear, just to be 100% crystal, or Crystal Lake, as the case may be, if the movie was trying to do that thing I was just expounding upon, oh, sex and death, blah, 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 that stuff is old as the hills and would not have automatically made the movie interesting or worthwhile.
No.
I mean, that is already what the Friday the 13th movies are about in a way that is, I mean, there's nothing subtextual going on in, like, Friday the 13th Part 4, but, you know, but the movie at least doesn't, I don't know, those old slasher movies were about sex being death and death being sex. I mean, there's a reason that the whole, you know, don't have sex thing became codified, the puritanical slasher who has it in for these hot hormonal kids. That was always what was going on. And so,
and speaking of,
shedding light on that has been boring for at least 20, 30 years.
And speaking of that sort of self-aware trope riffing, in the post-Scream era, it's become almost de rigueur to have your script littered with self-aware, look at me, I know how horror movies work dialogue, like every character is Jamie Kennedy.
Right.
Josh, when he and Nyla are running away from Millie in the butcher's body, he makes a crack about, like, you're black, I'm gay, we're screwed, or, you know, we're gonna die, or whatever. It's
in 2021, lines like that are just white noise to me. If he had opened his mouth and a blast of radio static had come out, it would have made me feel exactly the same way. It really is just like, I mean, the Scream had, as you said, a dedicated know-it-all Jamie Kennedy character.
And also, 20... 25 years ago.
Milli Vanilli times.
No, Milli Vanilli's even further back than that. That's how fucking dated that is. But no, 25 years ago, that sort of fourth wall breaking self-awareness was edgy and fun and kind of cool. And I mean, even going back to Scream now, it still works way better than any imitator since.
Yeah.
On that
score. I would agree with that endorsement.
It's so nothing.
I'm over it enough and have been for some time now that even Cabin in the Woods, while it tickled my funny bone, I still thought it was like a little self-impressed. I didn't adore it the way some people did. I still liked it, but I did still feel like it was a little late to the party. But if Cabin in the Woods is late to the party, then I don't even know what Freaky is.
The party's over. They showed up. Everybody's already gone home.
Yeah, the old mill is deserted once more.
Well, and for me at least, Cabin in the Woods, it was less funny for the trope deconstruction and more funny for the just like out and out zaniness that happens at various times.
Okay, yeah.
Like fucking Bradley Whitford getting eaten by a merman.
I mean, that is spectacular.
Yeah.
Everything to do with him and Jenkins, Richard Jenkins, is sublime.
Yeah, and him shouting at the screen while a bunch of Japanese school children banish Sadako or whatever. Again, it's the fact that it's absurd, not that it's, oh, we know how horror movies work. Look how smart we are. That wasn't what I liked about that movie.
So on the subject of faux or performative wokeness or trying to have it both ways, you talked before about how the cop sister training her gun on what's-her-name is bad optics. And there's a line, it was second only to the aforementioned toilet sex match cut in terms of like making my stomach flip a little bit. The butcher in Millie's body is, I believe she has just murdered the shop teacher and has emerged into the hallway, and a couple of cops walk right past her, you know, say, good afternoon, or something like that. Don't view her as a suspect, obviously. And when their backs are turned, the butcher says, hold on, I wrote it down.
Yeah.
Fuck off, piggies. And I think extends a middle finger, or
yes,
maybe
yes.
Not.
No, there's a middle finger.
And I just thought, you know, Zoomers who look like Millie are more likely to be into the whole ACAB thing than guys who look like Vince Vaughn. You know, like middle-aged white dudes. Like, Millie is in high school and Vince Vaughn is in S. Craig Zahler movies. You know, I don't... That doesn't track at all. I mean, no. I mean, it stands to reason, he's a murderer. He's on the wrong side of the law, but fuck off, piggy. It just seemed like putting those words in the killer's mouth, just if this movie was like trying to blow up its woke balloon, like that line just took a needle and just boom, pop, gone. All that. Yeah, I mean that was a spectacular fuck up, I think. And then at the end of the day, the cops show up just after the Freaky Friday switcheroo, where they wind up back in their original bodies, and Josh points at Vince Vaughn and says, "Shoot that motherfucker!" And then they shoot him. I don't even know how many times. And so it's just a movie that's, you know, I like a lot of movies where cops are the heroes. I would be cutting myself off from huge swaths of movie history were that not the case.
Right.
But this movie is kind of like lazily pro-cop in just such an unthinking, unfeeling sort of way, where it just doesn't feel like it got any consideration at all. And then you get scenes like the one that my co-host had trouble with, or the one that I just recounted. It's a movie that is ultimately building to this moment where two random cop extras
plug the guy until he stays down. This is your little sister's friend. You know this girl.
Right.
She's not brandishing the knife. She's like holding it down. She's holding it behind her back. It doesn't even make sense in like character context.
Right.
For her to be like, put it down, pointing the gun at her. She'd just be like, Nyla, what are you doing? No, why are you here? No, okay, put it back. Let's talk. It's, ugh. It would almost make more sense if the movie was trying to make cops look worse.
Like
if Charlene did that and then like ended up hurting Nyla.
Right.
In fact, I almost thought that might be where it was going, and then it doesn't.
Right.
Thankfully, I think.
I think that would have been too heavy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this movie is definitely not built for that at all. But that's the kind of scene that that was setting up.
It seemed that way, but at the same time, the impression I got wasn't, oh, Christopher Landon chickened out. It was, oh, it didn't even occur to him that
was weird. I'm not trying to suggest that he, like, started something he couldn't finish. It's just...
I just think he didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah, no, he stumbled into the setup for that sort of scene and then stumbled directly out of it again.
Right. You got, like, this close to pulling a Paul Haggis. I was already predisposed to sort of dislike this movie because this breed of horror comedy is sort of my least favorite kind of horror movie. I would rather watch a bad horror comedy in this post-Stranger Things 80s throwback zany millennial bashing totes magotes kind of mold is like more torturous than actual torture porn for me. I would rather watch a really dog shit worthless splatterhouse gore fest, grungy, grimy, like no redeeming artistic merit whatsoever.
Hostel 3.
Yeah, or whatever the fuck, anything you could possibly name. Like that to me is easier to sit with and spend time with than a movie like this when it's... I mean, you said when the credits started to roll that if a horror comedy, if the comedy shits the bed, you're just out of luck. You're up a creek because the horror in these movies is so often an afterthought or not even really meant to be scary. It's just a framework within which the comedy operates.
Yeah, horror comedies... more often than not in the last 5 to 10 years, it's just a riff on tropes.
Yeah.
There is no good faith effort to make any of the tropes or any of the movie around the tropes effective as a horror movie. It's just, this is nominally, structurally a horror movie, but only for the sake of the jokey jokes.
And I remember there being moments in Paranormal Activity, the marked ones, that made me jump. I might just have a thicker skin now, but you know, it's possible that if I saw that movie for the first time tomorrow, it wouldn't move me at all. But
I'm inclined to believe that, well, it also wouldn't help that we'd be rewatching it. I'm inclined to believe that if we watched The Marked Ones for the first time after we stopped recording this podcast, we would get a few jumps.
There are jolt moments in that movie that I still remember, which I cannot say about really any of the other Paranormal Activities, including the first one, with the exception of the very end of the first one.
Yeah.
I'm sure that got a rise out of me back in 20 whatever, the early 2010s.
2010 full stop.
Uh-huh.
Or earlier.
It might have been like 2009, then 2010 wide release or something like that.
Knows?
I really don't know. In any case, none of the subsequent Paranormal Activities, none of the numbered installments, and none of those sequels have done anything for me whatsoever. Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones, which they didn't even deign to slap a number on, is leaps and bounds better than any of the other fucking Johnny-come-latelys in that franchise. There are moments like, do you remember there's a scene where there's two guys, I think they're in an alley or maybe on a rooftop. They're beside a brick structure, a building of some kind, and they're whispering. They're like trying to lay low. One of them is going, Oscar! He's like trying to get the camera guy's attention,
mm-hmm.
and he's whispering. So automatically... And this is such a cheap trick. I should have seen it coming. You're like hanging on his every word because he's talking semi-audibly. And then bang, like a body hits a dumpster. This like falls into frame, hits a dumpster. There's this deafening clang. It's good shit. And I can see Christopher Landon trying to do those quiet, quiet bang moments in his comedy horror movies. Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones, is also funnier than any of
it's
these
true.
Other movies. Way funnier.
The scene, and I think you've referenced this in at least one other podcast episode, but there's a scene where after this kid gets these powers, he shoots a video of him doing all of these spooky tricks and puts it up on YouTube. And then the way this always goes in your average version of this scene is it blows up and it gets a bunch of hits and he gets YouTube famous. In this scene, he gets 11 hits and one comment, which is just fake and gay.
Right, or words to that effect. I know, yeah, speaking of the fucking gallows, I think I brought this up in Gallows Act 2.
Yeah.
Because it plays out as the more predictable route that you just described. Yeah, and I can see Christopher Landon trying to set up scares in his subsequent movies and the movie we're reviewing now, like when the kid is scooping the broken wine bottle glass off the ground. He hunkers back down, picks up more glass, stands back up 3 or 4 times, and the camera is going up and down with him, and you know that one of these days, it did feel like days.
Eventually he's
going to stand up and someone's going to be looming over him, but it doesn't inspire dread or even anticipation. It just feels interminable.
Yeah.
And a lot of the scare sequences in this movie sort of feel like that. You were perturbed by Millie scoping out her entire house when she finds the front door hanging open.
It takes so long, and there is
and the
no
movie already
tension.
Feels like it should have ended at that point.
Yeah.
So every additional,
this weird appendix of an
right,
ending.
Every additional
hanging
second
off the
feels,
intestines.
Feels like an imposition.
Yeah.
This movie and Happy Death Day to You are both saddled with a lot of really boring mom drama.
Yeah.
That stuff is pretty integral to Happy Death Day to You, and it didn't work for me, although it does form the dramatic spine of the thing. And we reviewed that way back, so I'm not going to get into it now. But
yeah.
Suffice to say, the relationship with the mom is a big deal in that movie. It would not be the same movie without it. You cannot say that about this movie. It feels really tacked on.
Yes.
And really incidental to everything else that's happening. There's way more of it than what we touched on in our plot rundown. There's a scene where Millie in the butcher's body bumps into the mom in a dressing room at a clothing store where I think the mom works.
Yes.
And they get into this back and forth where the mom tries to flirt with him in this sort of sub Back to the Future kind of way. And it's all to do with the dead husband and her being an alcoholic who doesn't want Millie to go away to college because she doesn't want to be alone. And it gets resolved in this really tidy. I found the mom stuff in Happy Death Day to You inauthentic to a degree where I thought, like, all right, well, clearly Christopher Landon is not writing from a place of experience here. But the fact that so much of the mom drama in this movie feels like leftovers kind of makes me think, okay, maybe he is working through some stuff, but then why does it sound so inauthentic? You know, the word I already used. I don't know. It just doesn't. It's weird to see that motif come back in such an unconvincing way yet again, but to feel even less material than it did the first time. I don't have that much more to say about it. I was just kind of...
Yeah, it's kind of superfluous. Doesn't really accomplish anything. I mean, like, in the closing scenes when Millie and her mom are cuddling, okay, they have their little, like, yeah, you can go off to college, it's okay, live your life, but we don't care. We could not possibly care any less. It's like, there is, in the early breakfast scene, Millie has to, like, hide a college application, presumably for some out-of-state school. I think later they say Boston or something. And it's not like this is the happy ending version of Run,
right?
the movie we did several episodes ago. This whole arc of going away to college doesn't matter. It's just kind of there. This whole movie is just kind of there.
Yeah, and, you know, Millie and Booker just sort of fall into each other's arms basically as soon as one of them makes a move. I mean, that's the main thing.
And they both liked
wants.
Each other all along.
Right.
Okay, fine.
And I get that when there's a masked slasher on the loose, especially one that's piloting your body, all of these things are supposed to fall by the wayside, but that's the way it should play. You know, when the dust has settled, it should just be like, oh my God, how did we ever think any of this mattered? You know, of course you can go to college. My God, you know, we've been through so much shit the last 24 hours. Baby bird's got to leave the nest. I get it. Instead, it's like this really pointed, like, Millie, it's okay with me. It's like she formally gives
yeah,
her permission.
And Millie says, no, I don't have to. And it's like, no, go. It's like mom is making a sacrifice. It's like, no, Ben Affleck, you have to get back in the spaceship and fly off of this asteroid. Exactly. The stakes are not that high.
Well, what Millie doesn't realize is after she spends her first night in the dorms, mom's going to go home, grab a bottle of Swan Song Chardonnay, and shove it down her own throat, and then splinter it. Yeah. I guess, and it's not a horror movie. The obvious recommendation, which I'm going to dispense with and say little else about, would be, I guess, Face Off. I think Face Off is the most fun of any movie with this premise. You know, I like the Lindsay Lohan Freaky Friday too, but Face Off is really where it's at. But I'm hard pressed to think of a truly great movie that does the body swapping thing in this sort of Freaky Friday fortune cookie magic kind of way. There just aren't that many of those movies, and most of them aren't that good. So my inclination was to do a hard left, as I so often do in this segment, and recommend something that sort of does the same thing, but in a very oblique way, and that's Lost Highway, David Lynch.
Okay.
Which does a switcheroo halfway through. Bill Pullman is the protagonist of the first half of the movie, and he finds himself in dire straits, which I only half remember, and it being a David Lynch movie, it's kind of hazy to begin with. Sure. But he's implicated in murder and mayhem. And then the movie pivots abruptly and becomes about this other dude living this other life. But then he starts to inexorably kind of, by the end of the movie, it's become, if not apparent, then at least sort of evident that they're the same person. And that, if you want to read it in the most kind of literal-minded Christopher Nolan kind of way, Bill Pullman had some kind of like psychic break and either fantasized about being another person living a different life, or had an alternate personality, or maybe there's something more esoteric than that going on. But in any case,
or maybe it's a John Woo thing where he changed
literally
his face.
Had facial reconstructive surgery. Or point being, they're two halves of some whole. And it's David Lynch, so you're not going to get much more precise answers from the movie than that. But it's really eerie, really unsettling. There's a character in it who figures prominently in the first half, and his return in the second half is what kind of heralds this Ouroboros shape that the movie takes, where, is it Balthazar Getty? Where Balthazar Getty becomes Bill Pullman again, is this eyebrowless man, pallid, sinister man from the Lynch dimension. I don't know. He's like the
this is Robert Blake.
It is Robert Blake. Yes, I was fumbling in my mind for his name and I couldn't find it. He's like the stock sinister David Lynch character, like the man from another place in Twin Peaks or the cowboy in Mulholland Drive.
But nobody... he also looks like David Warner from Dark City.
Right. Nobody does that character better than David Lynch, and I think that the mystery man in Lost Highway might be his best. It's good stuff, and if nothing else, the Balthazar Getty half of the movie features a all-cylinders-firing performance by Robert Loggia. He has the all-time greatest road rage scene I've ever seen in a movie. He gets cut off by this driver driving recklessly, and then proceeds to run him off the road and just open a can of whoop-ass on him. It's pretty glorious.
Yeah.
And unlike Vince Vaughn in this movie, Robert Loggia kicks a lot of ass while being extremely loquacious in a way that's a lot of fun and not just cumbersome.
Right. So I'm going to go in a different direction with a horror comedy that's kind of genre savvy. Very genre savvy. Obviously, we've touched on Scream and Cabin in the Woods, and those are fairly high profile. Chances are, if you're listening to a horror movie podcast, you have seen both of those movies and probably at least one of the sequels to Scream. So I recommend all of those movies. Even the weaker Scream movies are a more or less good time. But my actual recommendation is going to be Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
That's a solid pick.
It's Alan Tudyk from Firefly and other stuff, and Tyler Labine from a lot of shitty comedy movies, unfortunately for him, considering that at least in this movie he's rather funny. They both are.
Yeah, they've got great chemistry. Really makes the whole movie.
They play two rednecks who are basically on the wrong end of a group of teens who think they're in a horror movie.
Right. These teens keep meeting sticky ends, mostly through their own clumsiness, which is then attributed to the two bumpkins.
Yeah, and the two bumpkins are just innocent, goofy rednecks who can't imagine why these people don't like them.
It's really kind of touching. And it's a good... in a way, it makes more sense than my recommendation, because the other thing that Tucker and Dale does that's pretty funny is... like Freaky, it casts the protagonists in the role of someone with a kind heart who just looks like a killer.
Right.
You know? So you've got that, the same, like, but not in a contrived Freaky Friday. Like, no, guys, it's me. Look, I'll do the fucking the beaver dance or whatever. Here, they just look like they're out of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and no one takes the time to get to know them. So it's the same kind of mistaken identity gag. And Tucker and Dale just mines that for a lot more comedy gold than Freaky ever does.
The other good thing about Tucker and Dale is that its genre savviness and its awareness of tropes and use of tropes, it doesn't manifest in the form of throwaway lines of dialogue.
Or winks at the camera.
Right, it's structural. The scenes are built in a sort of through-the-looking-glass
yes.
version of murderous rednecks in actual horror movies played straight. And it's so much funnier that way.
Yeah, that's very apt. You would not have the movie without that comedy lens. I mean, it's applied evenly throughout.
So, yeah. Tucker and Dale versus Evil, good shit. It was on Netflix for a long time. It may have left. It may be back. But it's presumably findable somewhere. And it's well worth your time. As is Lost Highway, for very different reasons.
Yes. I'd say watch Lost Highway first. And then watch Tucker and Dale to cheer yourself up.
Yeah, palate cleanser, you know. Go to bed with Tucker and Dale on your mind, not Lost Highway.
Right.
Less likely to have nightmares. So, with all that being said, I think we'll wrap up here. Until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I am Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. See you later. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Freaky Official Trailer HD, uploaded by Universal Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, February 28th, and we'll be discussing the Train to Busan sequel, Peninsula. See you then.